I don't think leadership's exclusive. I think it can be very inclusive when we take the ego and put it to one side and just open up and share stories. And the leaders I see doing that are actually helping their teams navigate out of this crisis, this wartime, and building a new peacetime that's different from the past.
Welcome to Mastering Remote, the podcast that gives you expert advice to help you work smarter and manage better remotely. I'm your host, Christine Orchard, head of marketing here at ARC. In today's episode, I sit down with Dominic Price, the work futurist at Atlassian. We discuss several exercises you can use right now to be a better leader, how to keep your old habits from holding you back, and how to make experimentation a true part of your team's DNA. In addition, he'll share why and how Atlassian has decided to embrace being a hybrid organization. Let's get started. Hi, Dom. Welcome and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to chatting.
So let's start off talking about your title. You're called a work futurist. That's a pretty cool title. But most of us, I'm guessing, don't know what that actually is. So can you tell us what a day in the life of a work futurist really looks like?
Oh, yeah. If I'm honest with you, Christine, I think most of the people I work with don't know what it is. There is no typical day. And I think that's more common for most people, actually, these days, right? There isn't a Monday to Friday, 9-to-5 regime. For me, there's three aspects that I like. And today's had all aspects of that. There's been a whole sort of customer engagement, hearing stories about the challenges people are going through, the things that they're succeeding on, the things that they're still struggling with and trying to help them. Dealing with some of our internal teams at Atlassian, helping us scale and evolve. And what are some of the exciting experiments that we can try? And then a little bit of dose of Dom time. And so I made sure after a very early start today, because I was working from Sydney with some people in New York, that when I did get some downtime, I got myself a coffee, went for a stroll, consumed some fresh air, and just relaxed. And that's actually kind of a typical day for me.
Very cool. Now let's talk about the reworking work study. You and the Atlassian team decided to undertake this huge research project, and you talked to 5,000 people across industries to understand the challenges and nuances after people started working remotely overnight. What are some of the most surprising things you learned from doing this research?
I think there's a couple of things. One, the amount of people spending more time on work, which wasn't a massive surprise, but I was hopeful that actually working from home would ease our work burden a bit. So the coordination cost was something I hadn't anticipated. Everyone's become their own IT person, their own facilities person, right? Their own IT and technology expert. We've kind of added more time, but also our workloads. Some people think they've increased, others don't, but actually it's just taking longer to get stuff done. I think if you think about it, that kind of makes sense. Yeah, we had a stat that 42% of people are spending more time on work. And you're like, yeah, because even though we're doing the same tasks, those incidental conversations when I'd see you down the corridor, they're kind of not happening, right? And so over half the respondents said they were spending more time coordinating via email, SMS, Slack, different chat messaging services, just to get the same amount of work done. So if you think about it, it kind of makes sense because so much of our work is teamwork and we're used to being in a co-located space and it's been formal and natural to do that. And now we've put up this barrier that the digital world is just a different barrier. It's a different medium. And so now there is no such thing as a quick conversation. The smallest thing's like a half hour meeting, right? And so we're still learning what it takes to actually adapt to this. And then I think the other thing I think I knew, but was still a bit of a surprise, was we actually started to understand people's, what we're calling work-life impact. So what are the experience factors that change their work from home scenario? And the reason it's fascinating for me is I only ever see people through the lens of a camera now. And so all you see is what they choose to put behind them. What you don't see is what's behind the camera, the chaos, the children, the parents, the partner, the animals, right? The mess, the laundry, the bedroom. So we actually did this. It came out in the survey, but also we start to experiment internally. What does it mean? There's a lot of feedback from caregivers, right? In households who are saying, it's a lot harder for me to be effective. About 38% were like, it's a lot harder to be effective compared to with those with children. And then even whether you started or joined in COVID times, network quality and role complexity. And so actually in the US alone, 54% of people said their team would need to find new tools to collaborate because the complexity of their role doing it in this distributed world is a lot harder. The kind of things that we just bump into each other and talk about aren't happening. So there's a few surprises in there, but also a great reminder to us that our biggest asset is our people. And actually that's something we genuinely need to invest in to harness.
Now, the situation you're talking about here is something that both leaders and employees themselves are facing. So what would be a good first step for a leader to take to help set their teams up for success in this new paradigm we're all facing?
It's a great question. Let's start with an answer to a different question, which is, what are the things not to do, right? And the reason I mentioned this is I'm actually seeing those a little bit on repeat. One is ruinous empathy. I'm fortunate to have known Kim Scott privately and read her book around radical candor. And I've seen ruinous empathy where it's like, Christine's got a lot on right now. And so I've got this information. I'm going to hold it back from you because I don't want to worry you. The problem is you fill in the gaps because me as the leader not sharing that information, you start to wonder why I'm not sharing it. Have you done something wrong? You fill in the gaps, you make it up for yourself. You make it up way worse than any information or feedback I could give you. And ruinous empathy is happening on steroids right now. People are buffering from each other to try and help them. Actually, it's making things worse. I think the best leaders I'm seeing right now are demonstrating a couple of qualities. One is the vulnerability to talk about their own situation. Like, it's not great. Here's the upside. Here's the downside. Here's what I'm struggling with. And then the empathy to ask meaningful questions. I actually saw this with one of the leaders I work with the other day. We're having a meeting and he just sat there and said, right, everyone, out of five, how's your home life and how's work life? Go. Right. We scored it out of five. And then we just checked, like someone said, I'm a three. And he's like, cool. What can I do to get you to a four? Is there anything I can do? And it's like, first of all, empathy and asking people. And then secondly, action and saying, well, is there anything I can do to help? What can I do to help? And these don't seem like work conversations to a lot of leaders, but they are, right? Because if your biggest asset is your people, you have to find a way of connecting with them meaningfully. And I don't think anyone's thriving in this COVID experiment, right? There's no one high-fiving going, this is my perfect dream world. So just that small step can go an awful long way in building a meaningful connection with your people. And I think every leader has the potential to do that because it doesn't cost anything. There's no business case. There's no approval. It's not about title or role. It's just about caring for the people around you.
Okay, on the topic of vulnerability, I know it's easy to say, oh, just be more open with your people, you know, be more authentic. But it might not be natural for all of us to do just that. Or maybe it's not something that we've done in the past. So do you have any concrete ideas or maybe first steps to becoming a more vulnerable and open leader?
Yeah, I love that you've kind of confronted the elephant in the room there, because the reality is so many leaders just say the word vulnerable a lot. But like vulnerable, actually, is there's a reverse correlation. Like the more you say it, the less you do it. And so it's like, well, how can we actually demonstrate? How can we build the practice of vulnerability? One of the techniques we've been using in Atlassian, and I've been using personally myself, is called the four L's. I do it every 90 days on myself as a leader. And I ask myself on the previous 90 days, what's the thing that I've done that I've loved? What's the thing that I've done that I've loathed? What's the thing that I've longed for? I wish I was doing, but I'm not. And then what's the thing that I've learned? What's the experiment I ran on myself? And whether it worked or not, doesn't matter. What's the thing I learned from that? Sometimes I do that exercise with a coffee or a tea. Other times I do it with a Pinot Noir because it needs the kick of a jolt of alcohol for me to be honest with myself. Because as a leader, we've got to be honest. It's hard to put a mirror in front of yourself and say, what do I loathe? What's the thing I keep on doing as a leader? It's not making people feel inclusive or happy, or it's not paying back. And you've got to do that level of self-assessment and go, cool, that's an action I take. I can choose to stop that if I want to. And then I'm also going to choose to take the time that I save by removing that habit or ritual. I'm going to reinvest that in the longed for, the thing that I wish I was doing. And then you have to admit that the first time you do the longed for, the first time you try and build a new muscle, you're probably going to be crap at it, right? There's this weird myth that leaders are superheroes. Like you get to a certain level and you get the car parking space and you get the nice office and you get a superhero cape. And therefore you have to be right all the time. And it's not true. As a leader, I talk about decision-making percentages. I don't think I make a higher percentage of good decisions. I think what happens is the decisions have got more complex. I'm probably about 50-50 on success and failure, but they're getting harder and harder. And you're like, cool. Well, if you accept that not everything's going to go right, let's start with that attitude. Let's start with that approach. So the four L's is one that's enabled me to share with my peers and my friends and my colleagues, like, here's the thing that I love. It's probably my superpower. I'd love to do more of it. Own that, right? That's vulnerable in itself, saying, here's something I'm really good at. Will you give me permission to do more? Here's the thing that I loathe. Can you hold me accountable for stopping it? Here's the thing that I long to do. Like, Christine, I long to get better at podcasts. And you're like, that happens to be the thing that I love about myself. I'm really good at it. I'm like, cool, can you teach me? And then here's the thing that I learned to share the lessons around experimentation. And suddenly you feel this momentum build, not only because you're evolving yourself, but you've got a mechanism of conversation to share that vulnerability with people. And I think that goes exceptionally well when people can tap into that and do it genuinely.
So this is interesting that you talk about how you've done this for yourself. If we think about how you've done things at Atlassian more widely, how you get leaders to embrace experimentation, is there anything that's really worked well for you and the team in the last, say, 6 to 9 months? Concepts that have really helped you and the entire organization?
There's a few there that kind of operate almost in like perpetuity. One is our values. They operate in perpetuity because they set the foundation for how we act and how we turn up. We also have a values interview as part of our hiring process. So you can be the most intelligent technical person in the world, but if you're not a nice person, you're not going to get a job, right? So we're very conscious to not hire a highly technical, intelligent jerk. So the values enable us to say, what kind of people do we want? We want people that understand, be the change you seek, play as a team, you know, build with heart and balance. So we talk about these things, but under the banner of be the change you seek, every new starter we share with them, you're not here just to learn, you're here to make Atlassian better. So you have to drive change. And it's an amazing mindset shift of moving people from going, Atlassian, great place to work, I just want to work there and learn, to go, no, you're here to change it. You're here to make it better. Like, you're not the average, you need to be better than the average. So getting those values in place really helps. We then celebrate and recognize a lot of people that experiment and drive change. So we have this wonderfully simple system called Kudos. So Christine, you're doing an amazing job for me right now. I go online, go Kudos, put your name in. I know that you love white wines, a bottle of Chardonnay, and I send a note and I pick the value that you've lived. Christine's done an amazing job at play as a team. Here's how she's contributed. And you get called out for your contribution. So we've elevated recognition of like, how do we celebrate the positive behaviors? And then I think we just have an amazing culture around storytelling. We tell as many stories of success and failures, and this is at all levels, you know, junior to senior, left to right, up and down, people of all shapes and sizes, customs, cultures, backgrounds, it doesn't matter. It's this safe space to say, here's the experiment that we ran on our team, here's the hypothesis we had, here's what we assumed, and we got it wrong, and here's what we learned, and we're not going to do it again. And by the way, the reason we're sharing the lesson learned is so you don't make the same mistake. Just those elements suddenly elevate, and they make the lesson learned the citizen, the thing that you aspire to, not the success or failure. So once you make sure that people are learning along the way, experimentation just becomes the norm. And the more you celebrate it, the better you become. And you know, in COVID times, that has been a superpower for us. Like having that muscle already has made us feel way more adaptable and nimble than I think people even realize.
Do you think there was a difference in how you had these ideas before COVID? And then now that you're fully remote, was there anything different that you did because you're completely distributed compared to a hybrid or in-office team?
Yeah, I mean, we've had some really good remote practices. Since we acquired Trello a few years ago, I think our IQ and EQ on remoteness got a lot better. I think last year, probably before that, was a tad bit arrogant. We probably thought we were good at remote work. And then we acquired Trello and they've been built that way. And we're like, oh, we can learn a lot from you. And we did learn a lot from Michael Pryor and his team there. One simple example that they have this model, which is if one person dials in, everyone dials in. I remember the first time I was in a meeting, I'm like, but five of us are in Sydney, so it's fine. We can just get a meeting room. And they're like, no, if one person dials in, we all dial in. So it's a level playing field. And I was like, oh, you don't need empathy then. When you have a level playing field, you're all having the same experience. You don't actually need to waste any energy on empathy. I was like, that's genius. That was a bit weird and clunky at first. And then you're like, oh, it makes sense. So the leadership team that I'm a part of, for 3 years, we've been doing our meetings fully remote, even though five of us are in Sydney. If we're all in the same office, we all go to different meeting rooms. These little one-person pods, and we dial in separately because some people are remote. And so that muscle we already had. Where we've pushed the button on experimentation, which I'm enjoying right now, is really challenging ourselves. How much can we make asynchronous? So a quick example, we rolled out our strategy. We run our year from July to June. And as we were documenting our strategy for the next financial year, as a group of leaders, we documented those as videos. We saved time in people's calendars, but we said, here's everything to watch, both pages and tables and documents and background information and videos. We think it'll take X amount of hours. We've saved that time, but you can watch these whenever you want. And it was fascinating because before that, we would naturally pick a time that worked for San Francisco, kind of tough for New York, really good for Sydney. So Sydney morning, San Francisco afternoon, kind of late at night for New York, but no one in India can dial in. No one in Europe can dial in because it's the middle of the night. And so like, oh, it's fine. Just watch the recording. And you're like, hang on. That was a two-tier system. the people in these locations got it live. Everyone else got it recorded and played back. You're like, ooh. And it didn't feel hard for me because I was in the live group. I'm like, it's fine. It's fine for everyone. And you're like, yeah, it's not, is it? And so we're pushing way more of our meetings, formats, communications to be asynchronous and getting better at documenting them and storytelling. That means that people can consume them in a time that works for them, not just a time that works for us.
It's great that you're really working on asynchronous processes, which we know are a great way to make sure that your company is remote first. Now, I've also heard the rumor that Atlassian has decided to go hybrid. So arguably, this is one of the more complex structures. You know, half of your people at home, half of them in the office. This is difficult. Is there anything that you're working on right now to help pave the way and get yourselves ready for this new hybrid model?
I was hoping you'd have the answer, Christine. There's a few truths that we know, and you hit on one of them. It's going to be a damn sight more complex than a singular model, right? If we just said everyone stay working from home, that would be way easier to manage because it's the same for everyone. Let me first of all explain the rationale as to why we've gone hybrid. This was confirmed in the survey results externally. We also felt this from our survey results internally. We do regular pulse surveys with our employees, and we also already had a hypothesis. The time of one size fits all has gone. And actually what we're seeing is the need for mass personalization, where people are like, hey, Christine, here's my unique situation. Well, I'm Dom, here's my situation. So the idea of having a singular policy that works for everyone when you've got 5,000 people, that singular policies don't scream of flexibility or diversity or inclusion. They scream of, here's one way of doing it and we're going to force it on you. And that just doesn't sit right with us, right? It doesn't sit right with our ambitions around teamwork, our ambitions around building a sense of belonging and inclusion. Okay. What does that mean then? Well, it probably means we need multiple spaces to work in. I imagine some people will want to work in an office. Some may want to work at a customer site. Some may want to work from home, a co-working space, the kitchen, a friend's house, who knows? So the challenge that we're setting ourselves is how can we be place agnostic and purely focus on how we work? And if you think about it, historically, the two have been glued together. The way you worked and how you worked, we made the same thing. There's your desk. Here's your Wi-Fi connection, there's your machine, and the two were connected. And that's just a legacy and baggage from the production line. But there's over 1 billion knowledge workers out there in the world that aren't on a production line. So the idea of saying 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, Christine, there's your desk, it just doesn't fit with those people. Or even if it does, it doesn't have to. So what we're trying to detach is that connection and say, right, let's double down on how we work and let's make how we work inclusive so it doesn't actually matter where you are. And so, yes, in the future, I'm going to be on Zoom calls, but my workmates that happen to choose to be in an office somewhere, they're going to have a very similar experience to me. They're just going to bump into a few Atlassians when they go and grab their coffee. And I go downstairs for my coffee and I bump into a few people in my local area. Maybe that I do one day a week from the office or 2 days. It actually doesn't matter. It's about finding the mix that works for you and your team and the company and doing it that way around. So it is more complex. I do occasionally have sleepless nights trying to work out how we avoid two-tier systems, both of inclusivity, performance, perception, productivity. There's a whole lot of stuff that we have to solve there. We're adamant that it's the right way of doing it, and we're going to experiment with it. And as soon as we get any level of success, we're going to share it with all of our customers because we believe that we have to do it first so that our customers can benefit second.
I like what you're saying about location agnostic, and it's not about remote or office, it's doing your best work. And there are some roles or people who may prefer the office.
Yeah, even when you try and slice it by role, it doesn't always work that way because when you slice it by role, it assumes every role has the same tasks. And you're like, actually, no, it actually ends up slicing well by person when you're like, I like deep work. And when I do deep work, I do that best at home. Just like when I was at uni, some of my friends would go to the library to revise. I revised a lot better in my bedroom. If I was in the library, I just got distracted by stuff. It's not right or wrong. It's just different. So for me, I associate working from home with deep work. If I've got a gnarly complex task and I want to just get deep, you know, it's me. If I've got a gnarly complex task and I need to collaborate on it, I need people. And I get my energy from those people and I want them to spar with me and tell me I'm wrong and challenge me. I want to get on a whiteboard with them and have that thoroughly good argument. That's just a lot higher fidelity for me doing that in person. And if I want to build social connections, that's over a beer or wine or a coffee and a bite to eat. So that's the social aspect. For me, learning, I learn really badly online. Like you can send me the best webinars, the best LinkedIn learning. You can send me all the great stuff. I can't do it. But you put me in a room with a person and give me a chance to chat to them and I'll consume every bit of information from them. So we've all got different learning and communication styles. Let's embrace that.
Yeah, it sounds like in practice, this is going to be a lot tougher than we realize because we've grown up and we're used to these established systems and ways of doing things. So I've heard you talk a lot about unlearning, this concept that you believe is fundamental to how we adapt to the new future and whatever future lies ahead of us. So can you explain why you believe unlearning is really a critical leadership skill, especially now?
I think the first aspect is, I'm even old enough to remember this. I was taught that when I finished uni, that was my education done, and I'd work for 45 years and then retire, and then I'd be pushing up daisies somewhere, right? And there was this very formulaic approach to life. And then once I got into work, I was like, oh, I've not finished learning. In fact, I've not even started learning. I've got a few foundations of math, science, technology, English, whatever, but I'm like, the actual on-the-job learning and the learning new skills and new capabilities, I have to do that all day, every day. So once I realized that, I'm like, cool. And then I got full. I was like, I can't do anymore. I can't consume anymore. I have no more capacity. There's not enough memory or space in there for me to add. And what I was doing was I was getting knowledge obesity. I knew a lot of things. I was doing nothing with them. I was reading about agility and mindfulness and the growth mindset. I was reading all this stuff and then going, I have no time. There's a bit of an irony here. I've learned all this stuff. I've consumed the knowledge. I have no time to apply it. And thankfully, I'm good friends with Barry O'Reilly. Barry wrote the book on learning. It's an absolutely amazing read. He's got a website, a whole lot of stories and podcasts on there. And when I saw the concept, I'm like, yeah. If you imagine us as a bucket, the bucket's full. You've got to take something out before you put something in. And so unlearning is just this practice of saying, what got you here won't get you there, wherever there is, wherever the next thing is. So how do you pay homage to the past? How do you learn from it? How do you ensure that you're not anchored in the past? How do you find ways of ridding yourself of historical knowledge, rituals, habits, things that aren't going to pay a dividend anymore? Release those, thank them. We often talk about having celebrations for things of the past, even having a wake for them. And you celebrate them, and you go, cool, now that's gone. Right, let's focus on the future. Blank piece of paper. What does the future look like? What are the principles, philosophies that we care about, and how do we build for the future? And that just gives you that space and time and freedom to genuinely lean into it. And it's where you see at a business level, incumbent businesses just can't innovate. It's those incumbent businesses going, but we've made so much money doing it this way. Surely it's going to last, right? It's the blockbusters to Netflix story. It's like, but we're so good at this, surely. And then someone else comes along who doesn't have the constraints of your ways of working, starts with a blank piece of paper and invents the new version. And that's why so many companies find it hard to innovate from within, right? And to disrupt themselves. And that's something that we are adamant about at Atlassian. We reinvent ourselves regularly. And that takes a whole lot of senior leadership role modeling and storytelling, and then actively unlearning and celebrating the success of the past, but not allowing it to be the noose around your neck.
I really like the idea you said of having a wake and almost mourning something as you move on. Are there any other exercises or things that a leader might want to use if they're struggling to get the team to move on from the ways they've always done things?
Yeah, there's two that we've been using en masse that just pay huge results for us. One is called the Leadership Health Monitor. And we landed on what we believe are 8 attributes of a healthy leadership team. We've documented those. If you Google it, and I'll share the link with you to put in the show notes, anyone can use it. It's free. You don't need to sign up. You don't need to pay. We've got probably 500 plus teams across Atlassian globally. Probably 30, 40 leadership teams in there. And all these leadership teams have access to this health monitor. And it's as simple as standing or sitting around as a team. We often do it on Zoom or Trello or any other technology. And we read out the attribute of a healthy team. And then we vote. Thumb up, thumb sideways, or thumb down. Everyone votes and no one speaks. We do it silently. So you vote first, speak second. And that avoids groupthink. It avoids the leader going, we're doing really well at this, aren't we? And everyone going, yes, yes, Stone. Like, we're not. So everyone votes. Then we discuss. What did you see? Everyone sees the world through a different lens. What did you see that made you vote that way? And then as a team, which one area do we want to focus on getting better at? And then how we've got a whole lot of plays that we've documented that help you improve. And we found even teams that have got all of our A players in still struggle. They haven't got a huge amount of time. They're distracted. They've got multiple projects, lots of stuff on. We assume everyone thinks the same as us. We fill in the gaps when someone doesn't and we rationalize why. So that's a great level of to just go, how are we as a team? How are we working together? What areas should we improve on? And what it saves the leader doing is trying to sell the vision, right? You don't have to say to people, like, here's this big sales pitch and why we need to change. You get them to self-assess and go, oh, yeah, no, we're not great at this. We could be better. Here's the thing we could do to change. And you're like, hallelujah. It's kind of leading the horse to water, right? You've actually got to let them go on the journey and get there. The other one we've been using recently is an exercise we kind of borrowed from Amazon. It's either the painted picture or the press release. I did one with a team at an offsite a few weeks ago, and I'm like, right, 2025, let's write the press release. We nailed it. It's 5 years' time. Whatever we did, we have got like top marks on. We're high fives all around. It's amazing. One team went and did the press release. The other team did what we call a painted picture. What does the world look like in 2025? And what was our contribution to making it so good? And then we worked backwards from that to today. And it was a great exercise in just dreaming big first, unconstrained, be as bold or ambitious as you want, and then work backwards. And again, it wasn't about one particular leader or one person selling their vision. It was as a group telling those different stories and going, wow, I'd say probably the majority of the stories were better than mine. And I thought, as the leader, it's my job to present. I'm like, actually the best idea we came up with was the collective one as a team that was only a small percentage of mine. And of course I thought mine was good because I came up with it. But mine is only ever going to be through my lens, through my experiences in life, my history. So it's the old argument or the old idea of argue like you're right, listen like you're wrong. You know, present your idea with passion, but once you have, close your mouth and open your ears and listen with great intent to understand what other people are saying. And that was a great exercise in collectively trying to understand what that vision could be.
Yeah, Dom, these Atlassian playbooks are great. We've used them here in our team at ARC. I will link them in the show notes. They're really great. They give you a little more guidance for group activities or things to get certain conversations going in the right direction. So whether you do them physically, in person, or you do them over a Zoom call, they're a really great starting point for you and your own team. So I want to ask, Dom, if there's anything else you'd like to share with leaders out there who might be struggling, particularly this year.
So I'd imagine, like you say, most leaders are. And if you think about it, whatever country in the world you're in, most economies in the world were going through some level of success. You know, if you're a leader, you've managed through a thriving economy and workforce recently, and now we've gone into crisis mode. We've gone from peacetime leadership to wartime. And wartime leadership's a different skill set, right? It just is. And I think it's challenging, certainly for leaders who have grown up in a certain environment. These are very different conditions. So what I'd encourage leaders to do is, one, take some time out for themselves. Like, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first before you help anyone else. You've got to be the best version of yourself, whether it be mindfulness, taking time out, exercise, fresh air, family time, community time. Don't burn yourself out, because then you're no use to anyone. And then once you believe you've got your own balance, just find a way of using storytelling or asking questions to actually navigate through this as a team. I meet with a lot of leaders who are lonely because they think leadership's a lonely job. And I don't think it needs to be. I don't think leadership's exclusive. I think it can be very inclusive when we take the ego and put it to one side and just open up and share stories. And leaders that do that genuinely become a force multiplier in their organization. They don't think about process and management and control. They think about influence. They think about people, and they think about inspiration. And it's a very different mindset. And the leaders I see doing that are actually helping their teams navigate out of this crisis, this wartime, and building a new peacetime that's different from the past. They've acknowledged it, they've paid homage to it, but they're not holding their breath waiting for the old normal to return. They're getting on with building a new, better normal, and they're embracing that uncertainty. They're not hiding from the uncertainty, they're just going, it's uncertain. It's messed up right now, it is. Let's move on. What can we do rather than what can't we do? And I think when you combine those mindsets of looking after yourself first and then realizing that leadership doesn't need to be a lonely sport, eventually you realize that we're all in this together. And I genuinely believe we can build a better future. Admittedly, we're going through a terrible experiment right now, but I believe the lessons we can learn from this and the things that we can apply will build a better future than the past than we had before.
So before we conclude, I have a few fun, short questions for you. They're rapid fire, so just answer with the first thing that comes to your mind.
Born ready.
How do you like to take a break when you're working?
What I need to do more is my digital detox, when I completely remove myself from email, Slack, any conversation, and I immerse in something. Last year, I went to Japan with a good friend of mine, and we watched the Rugby World Cup. And I did no work. We traveled around Japan. We ate amazing food, the customs, the cultures, the beer, just the energy of the event, and I was fully immersed in it. And when I do that, I genuinely recharge.
Digital detox, yeah, I think that's a great answer. Is there any book that changed your life?
I read a lot of psychology books as a teenager because they absolutely fascinated me. But the interesting thing on books for me is I can't read business books anymore because they bore me rigid. So I only read fictional books now because they allow my mind to wonder and be curious. So I reckon about once every 2 weeks, a new author will send me a book that they've written and I'll flick through it and then I'll donate it to a friend. Because I find business books are so normalized and there's so many of them that actually I much prefer fiction. So fictional stories for me just allow my mind to go to crazy places. I've been reading a lot of Lee Child. So I just love, I mean, other than the fact that Tom Cruise completely ruined the movie because the character is meant to be 6'4" and Tom Cruise isn't. Other than that, and I do hold it against him. The Lee Child books are great. I can immerse in them. It's a good story. I can imagine them and see what's happening. And I just find it very enjoyable and quite relaxing.
Okay, final question. What, if any, is your favorite remote work productivity hack?
I really hate productivity hacks, but if I had to pick one, I'm so against productivity right now. I think it's the thing that's killing our workforce. But if I had to pick one, because you're forcing me to, I flick one meeting a day from Zoom to phone and I put my AirPods in and I walk and talk. And it gives my eyes a break. It gives my brain a break. I engage in a different way on phone. Actually, this is a weird productivity hack. I now have an end of day routine because we're talking in my lounge where my laptop is. At the end of the day, I turn my laptop off, make myself a tea, got a playlist, and I sit on my balcony, listen to the music whilst the sun goes down. Then when I come back in, the lounge is the lounge. It's no longer my workspace. It's the lounge. And it doesn't help with productivity, but it means at night I'm not tempted to work as much.
But I like that you acknowledge, right, that it's not necessarily a productivity hack, but it's a routine that allows you to be a better person, a more well-rounded person, you know. Whether that's exactly productivity, it's still a good answer. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I learned so much from you, and I'm really glad that I could have you today on the podcast. So we'll see you next time, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to Mastering Remote, a podcast brought to you by ARC. We make it easy for you to hire senior remote developers, pre-vetted and tailor-matched to you. Check us out at arc.dev. If you enjoyed the conversation today, go ahead and subscribe to be the first to know when our newest episodes of Mastering Remote go live. See you next time.